This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show.
All righty, good people. Welcome to episode 418 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And today is a very special day because not only do we have Billy Gould and Jared Bloom on today's show, but they are announcing a brand new soundtrack album to the movie The Eclipse with a super limited vinyl run of only 300 units. So you better get in quick. It's at Subsound Records, which is at subsound.bigcartel.com. I've got a link directly to order in this episode page. Click there and secure your copy today. Only 300 vinyl copies are being made, so definitely do not sleep on this one. Now, today we talked to Billy and Jared all about a myriad of topics, including how the soundtrack came together, the story of The Eclipse and connections to Serbia, Billy's Cool Arrow Records, the new Sleep Bomb LP, the soundtrack to The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. We even get into some Faith No More history, as well as the story of Shandy's addiction, the project that Billy once did with Tom and Brad of Rage Against the Machine, as well as Maynard of Tool, A Perfect Circle, and Pucifer. And by the way, there is an extra 30 minutes or so of this discussion available only to show patrons at patreon.com/vinylguide. More questions, more music talk, more hilarity, and it's only for the absolute dead set legends who help support the Vinyl Guide podcast at patreon.com/vinylguide. Head up there now, become a Patreon Vinyl Guide legend, and enjoy all the extras, including 30 more minutes of talk with Billy and Jared. And finally, there are a ton of other episodes of the Vinyl Guide podcast available to enjoy anytime, including the first time that Billy and Jared were here on The Vinyl Guide, episodes 217 and 218. Still in the Faith No More universe is Trey Spruance of Mr. Bungle, Secret Chiefs, and More, episodes 180 and 181. Memories of Mr. Bungle with Bear McKinnon and Danny Heifetz, episode 402. Willie D of the Ghetto Boys, episode 172. The always hilarious Jello Biafra, episode 160. Justin Chancellor of Tool and MT Void, episode 417, and lots more. Just follow the Vinyl Guide in your podcast app. Scroll, download, listen, and enjoy. And with that, let's get straight into our conversation with Mr. Billy Gould and Jared Bloom on the original soundtrack recording of The Eclipse and a whole lot more. So this week on the Vinyl Guide, we've got Billy Gould and Jared Bloom of nice. Talking Book. Is it still Talking Book?
Sort of. It's not. There's three of us in Talking Book, actually. Okay. So we're calling it Billy Gould, Jared Bloom, but it's kind of like two-thirds of Talking Book. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. And there's a new project now. This is going out on October 16th, which I believe is the big reveal, the launch of the album. It's a soundtrack to a film called The Eclipse. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. Excellent. And people can go to coolarrow.com, cool with a K, arrow.com, and be able to hopefully snag one of those 300 vinyl copies. And that's it, just 300, and it's gone. So you kind of got to get that's one right. of those. Or I've heard the digital files. I can't wait to get my analog copy, but I've heard the digital files. It's gorgeous. The dynamics are absolutely stunning. And what was interesting is when we last spoke, this is right in like April of 2020, right as the pandemic was taken off. The question was asked, you know, do you think you guys will ever do a soundtrack? And the answer was like, oh, maybe, I don't know. And here we are. How did this happen?
I've known the director for a long time. I met her about, God, it must be in the late 2000s, around 2007. And she had sent me some of her films. So we kind of stayed in touch. She knew about like Faith No More, obviously, but we, you know, we just kept in touch on the email, and she worked on a couple projects, like a project in Nepal. And she came out here, her film was in a film festival, and we've just kind of always swapped stuff. And when we did Talking Book stuff, I just always sent her stuff because she's a visual artist and this is visual music. It just seemed like a natural thing that to turn her on to something cool that I was working on. Mm-hmm. She came probably right after we did the interview with you, probably not much long after. She said, I'm working on this film that I've been working on for a couple of years now, and you guys have to do the soundtrack. And that's where I said, okay, yeah, let's do it.
And that process, because as I understand, when you guys work together with Talking Book, understanding Talking Book is a trio, this is a duo, but Talking Book seems to be on your own time. Like there was one release in 2012, one in 2012. It takes their time. Now you're on someone else's clock. Is that how was that?
You know, the hardest part really was just, I mean, having this big gap of film, this big, huge space, and feeling like, what do we do? How do we start this? What's the approach?
How do you start it?
Well, she sent us some video to like kind of watch and feel out, and we sent her a bunch of demos. At first, she didn't know what she wanted, and we Bill worked on some stuff, like more musical stuff, and then but she knew she wanted some more abstract sounds. So like I remember sending her a bunch of demos of just stuff that I had done like in the Talking Book vein, and she was like very into that, going back, bringing it back to like the Talking Book sound, which was what it is. And so once we kind of got that as like, okay, we got the green light to kind of
Right.
go there
That's
and
the
not,
language. Yeah.
like go there. We want that.
Do you get like a raw file of or a rough cut of the entire movie, or do you just get segments that you work towards?
I think that's what we had, but it got edited as well, you know. So we kind of, it was really interesting, actually. We kind of winged it a little bit here
It
and
was
there,
definitely
you know.
winged, and I think that's why I remember the first scene she sent us was a scene. It was a reenactment of a real thing that had happened in the 90s. It was her father was driving a car, and the whole car was full of books. And I was like, this is really weird. And but it was very like he was just driving, and there was no sound. It was just this old man driving a car with a back seat full of books. And I just put something to it, and she was like, yeah, that's exactly what I wanted. And I was like,
I
okay.
mean, our previous Talking Book stuff, you hear a lot of this kind of, there's a lo-fi ism or a kind of, you know, a very evokes very much past vibes, old vinyl, things like this. And you know, with her films with the Super 8, you know, and these kind of scenes, like the father he's talking about, you know, with the books, it's an old Yugo car, you know, looks like it was filmed in like, you know, 1981, 1982. It's like, psht. So, I mean, she's being a visual person, sometimes it's hard to think in music. You know what you want, you feel what you want, but you can't describe it that well. And I think, you know, we're trying to figure out what she means by it. But, you know, if you look at just the way she filmed visually and the way we approached the sound, it kind of really, the less thinking we did about it, the more it seemed to make sense.
I've seen just little clips online. It's got like almost a Tarkovsky feel
Oh, absolutely that.
to the film.
That's right. That's right.
But I haven't found a place to be able to watch the whole film yet,
I
and I'm guessing
know.
it's
That's what
nowhere.
we need to find out. Like she needs somehow it's got to get out because it won a bunch of awards this past summer. Not this past summer, last summer through film festivals and stuff. It was in a bunch of film festivals and it got great reviews and everything. So I don't know where movies like that end up. Like documentaries and stuff. Like I don't know where they end up in the world of in the internet world. I don't know what streaming where they live, but it would be nice if people could see it because it's a beautifully shot movie and
Highly regarded.
it's a true story. I mean it's
It's
hard. It's
that's the
hardcore, and I
thing.
think people
It is. It's an historical document in a way. I mean, a lot of things that were in this film, I wouldn't have known if I hadn't been going there and spending time. And even things that I didn't know were in that film. Great for people to see because it's kind of a document of, you know, somebody's life through a certain period of time that was happening in the world that really didn't get recorded, you know. It's also kind of in another way, it's a kind of reconciliation for people who live there because it's very truth-telling without pointing fingers, but people who lived it, and part of the theme of the film is people don't like to talk about it. So yes. It's very much like opening a wound, you know, there's very much that vibe to it.
Right. So people who may not mm-hmm. know what we're talking about here, the film is a documentary. It has to do with the Bosnia-Herzegovina, the Serbian conflict. Is that right?
It does. It has to do with the director growing up in Serbia and with the history. All that was one of the things. It was also the Serbian-Croatian war that happened before that. It was also about World War II. Just about all of these things that happened in this little area where her grandmother grew up and where she grew up that were so thick that she had to leave. And she kind of came back and tried to interview her family and bring that up and find out what was that thing that made her want to leave so badly. Mm. So it's a very heavy. I mean, if you don't know the history, I think that the beauty of how she shot it, you're going to feel a lot of the feelings of that, you know, that vibe is very heavy. She did a very good job there.
Yeah. Because at the time when that was all in the news, that wasn't anything that I and maybe a lot of people my age really paid a lot of attention to or knew
absolutely.
Much about it. And
so,
not really. And the stuff they did show was really superficial. You know, it's really like newsworthy, you know, 1 minute soundbite stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, they still live with that, but we do too. I mean, you know, there's still a connection with what's happening in Ukraine now with what happened there then. I mean, this is all a very fluid part of the world mm-hmm. and nothing comes from a vacuum, you know?
Now, you seem to have a lot of connections with Serbia. Do you have family experiences from that region? Like what's the background?
That's so weird. Not at all. My family on my father's side is Hungarian and they were Jewish. So the family history kind of got wiped out. I went to Hungary and I like Hungary. I think Budapest is a great city. With it, the more we played a lot. And I always really, I liked it there. I love the food there. It's freaking phenomenal. But when I went to Serbia, it was like I felt like I was kind of home, and it didn't – it was weird. It just really mm-hmm. connected to it. I mean, I love Bosnia. I love Croatia, Macedonia, Albania. I love Albania. I love the whole region. They're all very different from each other. But Serbia is like a real – there's something about that I really feel a connection with the food and with just people and their sense of humor. And I found out later my mother for my father got one of these like Holocaust detectives who could find out where your family tree, you know, comes from. And it was actually right on the Serbian-Hungarian border. It wasn't Budapest at all. So that was really interesting. I thought that was interesting. Somehow maybe there was a sensibility that got passed through my family that I picked up on in a very unconscious way. That's the only thing I can think of. That's the only thing that makes any sense.
All right. Because, you've got the liquor company. You've got a few other things that are kind of coming from that region.
Yeah.
I always assumed he must have some family roots or maybe even spent time there as a child, but no, not the case.
It's just a weird thing. I just really like it when I'm there. I really, it's just a cool place.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And what does it mean for you to be involved in a movie like this with those sort of, I guess, spidey sense connections, like, you know, to be helping tell this story?
In a way, I'm a little. It makes me hesitate a little bit because this is I'm sticking my toes into something that isn't my thing actually. I mean, this is really, really highly charged stuff. I want to be first of all respectful, and second of all, don't want to be American about it. If that makes any sense, I don't want to project any of my garbage onto this thing. So I was super, super sensitive about making sure the director was connecting with it. Like maybe overthought it even a little too much.
But she, obviously was in charge of the movie and the final edit and everything there. In terms of your music, the discussions that you had with her, I mean, she's overseas, you're in California, and now Jared's in Texas. You guys weren't even in the same room. I mean, how do you collaborate in that sort of environment?
She gave us a lot of free reign to do what we wanted, really. Mm-hmm. And it really, Jared and I kind of worked out how things fit.
Yeah.
And what, 90% of the time, 95% of the time, she was completely pretty much happy with what we gave her with maybe small comments.
Yeah, it was a couple of edits here and there like, oh, can you do this? Can you do that? Can you make this longer? Can you not use this sound? Can you shorten, stuff like that. But she trusts. Yeah, she, I don't know. I know it's weird. Like if I was a filmmaker and I got music back from a composer, I don't know. Like I would feel a little intimidated to tell the composer like, no, but like she didn't really have to do that because, the other thing is by the time I started getting going with my scenes, I was watching. Then she sent me like actual video, and I was actually watching it and playing along with the sound of the film. So whatever people were speaking, there was background ambience and all that. Mm-hmm. I was playing to that. I was recording to that, which was different than most people just record to silence. But because it's like a documentary, there's not much. There's just ambient sound. There's a couple sound effects thrown on, just like sound effects, meaning like just enhancing things, but nothing superficial. And it was just like playing to that. And it actually allowed me, this is the first time I was able to actually really write minimally. And it's changed my way of thinking now in terms of writing. And it was such a great exercise, but also like a great way to, I think a lot of musicians should start doing that, is just writing to something with sound already and see if they could fit in their sounds to that picture. And then also keep, like, and keep some of the background sound in there, because it does help dictate your choices. It was like a revelation that I wish someone had passed on to me like 10 years ago. But
it's funny. I come from the music thing of, you know, being in a band and writing music for albums, and, you know, which I'm always preoccupied with, is this part going on too long? Is it boring? You know, you're always trying to keep tension and something to keep the thing alive, you know, so people don't, you know, you don't daydream, you know, and this is the exact opposite. I mean, where less is more, where if you go into it with that attitude of trying to keep it exciting, you're actually really kind of taking away from the actual visual of the film. You really have to step back. You really have to it's counterintuitive. You know, I hadn't done this before. So is for it me, it was extremely counterintuitive.
Is it like putting yourself in like a servant position in that regard?
Bit of it? It's more of just like putting like, what would I want to hear here if I was watching this? You know what I'm saying? Like, you don't want a lot of music, you know, and there's times when you do. There's moments in the film where like there is like this, and she used it. So like Bill did a track. It's at the end of the movie that's so effective. And it's not like, I think it's I don't know what you did, but it's definitely like layered of sorts, but it's
in the crescendo a lot. Yeah.
It's huge, but it like would only work as the ending thing, as you're like,
that's right,
walking, or as you're like, God damn, that was a heavy film, you know, but like for the scenes where there's anything else, it's sort of like just the minimal stuff really works. Now, again, I'm not sure if it totally works as a record. But for me,
yeah, that's a whole other thing. Yeah,
that's a whole other thing. And that whatever, like, I don't care about that. Like, I had to add on like a minute to every song just to make them into songs, because I was writing to picture, and there might have been the scene that was 42 seconds and that's it.
So that's interesting, because last time we were speaking about soundtracks, and where a soundtrack to me, and I'm not a huge soundtrack collector. I appreciate them, but it's not something that I go to a lot. But when I hear a soundtrack, it almost creates a movie in my head. But now there is a movie. You guys do have a movie in your head. We don't. So when I listen to the music the other day, I was kind of making my own assumptions for it. So it's you almost, as a musician or someone who gets familiar with the soundtrack and the movie, are almost at a disadvantage at that point, because you only have one linear tale. Can you disassociate those two now?
I mean, I can, because that's the music I listen to. See, it's different. Like if you're used to listening to experimental-ish instrumental music, minimal music, then it's not going to be that much of a like a whoa. But for other people who don't, are not used to that kind of music as a daily thing, like I am, it's definitely like, oh, this sounds like film music, you know. So but for me it's totally like in it's on par with the stuff I listen to, which is like moodier, you know.
Yeah.
Stuff music. And I think the let's say the Talking Book record that we did, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, if you took little chunks of those parts and made them and then use them for a movie, like just 30 seconds at a time, they're totally cinematic. But when you're making a record, then you have to make a 3-minute song to make it listenable for someone who's not watching. So it's like a whole other thing. I personally kind of like this approach and not the like listener. I don't know. I go back and forth because I listen to so much music and go like, wow, this is so minimal. Like, how did this composer just sit there and not think this is boring? You know, but like, it's a famous musician or whatever, you know what I'm saying? And I'm not knocking my friend Dominic, who we play with. We talk about this all the time about how to make something minimal, but interesting. And how, where's the line? And there's so many guys out there who make stuff that's so minimal. You're just like, it's incredible. Like their patience. Mm-hmm. I don't have that.
Yeah, the patience is amazing. No, me neither.
That's it's the tough. Thing.
It's a real discipline.
Bill, like I come from a composer's background. I come from a rock background. I come from like, okay, let's go. I want 3 minutes in, 3 minutes out, done. Like, let's get apart.
Make your statement. That's right.
Yeah, which is cool. Like, to like, I think in a way, like, we kind of do a rock version of experimental music in some way or another. But you know, it's just there's also other times when you can do other stuff and work with a picture. I'm telling you though, like I wish you could see the movie, because when Bill and I have seen it in the theaters, I've seen it like 3 times now in a theater. And it's so much more effective in its short burst with the sound of the theater, too, because no one's going to sit. No one has that in their house. Most people don't. And it's really.
But, you know, making a Blu-ray DVD would be amazing. Like a DVD with this, like that you could watch on your system at home.
Sound awesome.
That would be really. That's the way to really hear this and see it, you know.
Mm-hmm. But also, like, it was remixed in Denmark. By those two guys, our buddies. Right. So like everything was mixed to film within a beautiful studio. And so like it's different than when you get it from, I'm not downplaying the record. The record's great. I think I like it. I love it. No, I'm proud of it. I'm just saying like music in the music with the visuals is such a different thing than hearing it.
Yeah.
And then again, like then you go back and listen like Marconi from like the movie, like, those are different. I don't know why, but like those movies were like, those were like songs, you know, like Once Upon a Time in, you know, in the West or whatever.
Big
like
themes. Those are
like
yeah.
Music and people like you could play those in an orchestra and it's totally fine. But like this kind of music is very, it's not just cinematic, but it's very like, it's so part of the picture.
Yeah.
That it's, yeah, but I listen to a lot of music that is like this for picture and not for picture. So to me, it's totally normal. But it's just where people are at. I mean, that's the whole thing with music.
So in going into this project, and Billy, you work with Patton, who does soundtrack work,
right?
You know, and right. I thought that was very interesting. Two soundtrack composers now in the same group there. I don't know how rare
that
is.
Roddy does too, right? Roddy does.
Oh, Roddy does.
Okay. And Roddy does too.
Did you absolutely, see, yeah. Did you seek counsel from those guys? Did you talk about that at all?
Not at all, actually. Roddy, I did in the very beginning. I just I called him up and said, how do you score a film? We have this film to do. How do you do it? And he's like, don't worry about it. It kind of just less is more, and it kind of just kind of works itself out. And I'm like, that's not very helpful. But
less is more is really, I mean, that's all that really comes down to.
And everything we've just been talking about, basically what he said was completely on the money. It just didn't feel like that at the time. It's like,
absolutely,
can you give me a little more technical info, please?
Thank you, Confucius. Can I get something practical now? So but you guys working together, you've always had the indulgence of letting things percolate, take time. And, you know, if it's not ready, it's not ready. Here you're on someone else's clock. Was that a different experience?
Right. I don't think so. I think we got to work and she was still working on the film when we were basically finished, right, for quite a while.
Yeah. There wasn't this like hard cutoff.
No.
It wasn't that it was a pleasure. Let's put it that way. For me, to do. Also,
this wasn't like maybe a big budget Hollywood film where there's a lot of people getting paid that need to get this done on a deadline. Like, this just wasn't that kind of a film, you know?
Only one person.
So the pressure,
you, like,
that pressure is down. Right. It's all aesthetic pressure. Yeah. Yeah.
Now this is a full album. And again, like I said, there's 300 units that are going to be made. CoolArrow.com. They could order them. Probably should do it fairly quickly. Is it going to be on?
There's also an Italian label we're doing this in cooperation with called Subsound.
Subsound.
So we're doing it. Us and Subsound are doing this together. So you can also go to the Subsound site and order this as well.
Okay, I'll try.
Sell out twice as fast now.
Okay. And it's going on all digital platforms and everything else too.
That's what I was going to ask. Like, okay, the unlucky.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. It'll be everywhere else. It's going to come out in November on all the digital platforms.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. And Cool Arrow, from what I understand, is also recently doing some additional soundtrack work. I think Sleep Bomb is coming out.
Okay. It's funny. This is very interesting that these are both happening at the same time and they're both visual related. Sleep Bomb is a San Francisco band, actually, who have been for the past 20 years doing soundtracks to films that are like public domain films like Nosferatu and The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari is one of these that they do. And they've got to the point now where they kind of wanted to document it and do some, they're starting to do tours and do these, like with the pandemic, it was really great for them because they could play like outside, you know, open air, stuff like that. And they have this kind of approach to these soundtracks that's very doom metal. That's super cool, actually. I saw them do Conan the Barbarian and I was like, this is actually really awesome. I would never have expected it, but it absolutely fits perfectly. So yeah, these guys, I'm putting these guys out next week is their record release party. And that's going to be a vinyl as well.
Okay.
A limited vinyl through Cool Arrow. And then the Eclipse comes out a month later.
Does it come with the DVD, like a copy of Cabinet of Dr. Caligari? It's public domain, so I'm assuming that
they made Blu-ray DVDs that go with this because it's public domain. Yeah, they made their own. We actually mixed it in Atmos for this, so it should be really cool, actually.
Wow.
Now, I used to be, you know, Jared and I were talking about synthesizers a while ago, but I used to really be into silent films and you know, things like Metropolis or a Battleship Potemkin, some of those films again.
Sure.
I think the challenge with some of those films, especially trying to write a soundtrack to them, is there's various versions. They're cut up. They roll at different speeds. So you know, syncing up.
That's
to those.
True.
Didn't think about that. Right.
How does a band like Sleep Bomb, or would you know how they engineer around something like that?
Well, this is, you know, it would have to talk to them technically, but I know they had a problem that was like a 15-second difference between the film they had and what worked. They had a tough time tracing down why that actually happened. I think they found a way to sort it out and resolve it. And I didn't get so involved in the mechanics of it. Those guys are really clever, especially the guitar player. He does like a lot of film conforming to film and stuff in his job. He works at University in Berkeley in the audiovisual department. But it did get a little weird with the different sound and formats where the links actually changed. That's true.
Yeah, there could be 100 different versions of a film, like, you know, this great version in the archive. They cut 6 seconds out in Brazil because you couldn't show a knife in 1923 or something bizarre.
Crazy. Oh, wow. Right.
Yeah, wow.
Right, right.
So, yeah, it just seems like soundtrack central for Cool Arrow these days. Is that the... You know?
This year, I would say, yeah, it wasn't planned that way, but this is how it's worked out. And it's cool. I mean, for me, it's interesting. It's kind of, I mean, really, a band could do anything now. They can record themselves at their house. They can release it already on the digital networks themselves. They don't, what Cool Arrow was 20 years ago when I started this, it's a different world now, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
I don't need to be getting in the middle of them, between them and getting it out in the internet. They can do that themselves. But for something like this, these are kind of interesting ideas. This also helps, it kind of supports, like, in the pace of the Eclipse, it brings the independent filmmaker into it, you know? In a way, it kind of keeps this film and keeps a life of it and keeps, you know, it contributes to something that probably wouldn't be getting done in this, on a certain level. And Sleep Bomb as well. They're doing something really interesting with the medium that I think, okay, this is something a little bit different. If you hear these just on Spotify and you don't have the visuals, it's not going to be the same thing.
Right.
But it's kind of cool to be involved in this where I think I can use my vehicle and do some good with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I always say Cool Arrow, everything that comes out on Cool Arrow is interesting, right? It's one of those labels to where it goes from.
I hope so. To me, it is.
to me, it is too. I mean, you can go from something like a soundtrack work to DeBoja Collective,
right?
To a lot of music that is non-English. Then here's the Faith No More first record remastered. Right. It's quite
amazing.
Let's spend a few minutes. I want to talk about some of the other projects for a bit, if that's all right, Billy. Mm-hmm. Shandy's Addiction. this project, and I remember hearing this off the Kiss My Ass compilation.
Right.
Can
that's
you talk
right.
a little bit about, as I understand, Maynard from Tool, a couple guys from Rage Against the Machine. How did that project come together?
We'll be back after these messages.
There's no doubt about it. Record collecting has become a serious hobby and even an investment for many around the world. So record collectors have to ask themselves how best to protect their prized records and confidently buy and sell with others. There is an option to consider. Vintage media grading at vmgvinyl.com. Vmgvinyl.com will professionally grade your record and encase it in protective plastic, so your record will retain its value for decades to come. This is the same approach that comic book and sports card collectors have done for years. Now, I know many record collectors will be horrified with the thought of having their records graded and encased in plastic. And for the majority of records, this isn't necessary. But if you have top dollar records that you need to protect, maybe a super rare album that's languishing on the shelf, a one-off misprint, or a special LP that you want to protect, look up vmgvinyl.com, Vintage Media Grading, and see if this service is right for you. That's Vintage Media Grading, vmgvinyl.com.
Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits.
Shandy's Addiction. This project, and I remember hearing this off the Kiss My Ass compilation. As I understand, it's Maynard from Tool, a couple guys from Rage Against the Machine. How did that project come together?
Well, Kiss decided they wanted to put out a record of bands doing covers to their material. And it got to our management, who at the time was also managing Rage Against the Machine. Mm-hmm. So I'd seen Rage. I kind of knew the guys, but not too well. And my manager was like, hey, so Tom and Brad want to do this Kiss cover. Do you want to do it? And I was like, I grew up loving Kiss, so I was like, yeah, hell yeah, why not? It would be a fun thing to do. And they were going to have this guy, Maynard, who was Tom's old roommate. He was going to sing. And I didn't know Maynard, never met him before. And we kind of just met. We rehearsed the song, and we kind of did it the way we would do it. I kind of attacked it on bass the way I play bass. Mm-hmm. And they kind of really, if you look at listen to drums and guitar, it sounds Rage Against the Machine, I guess. It was just us being, what would we do to make this song? Because we all grew up with Kiss. And we recorded it like in a day, very fast. Then Maynard had to fly in to do the singing, and there was a studio up here. So I picked him up from the airport. It was really interesting, actually, because he was very quiet, not talking very much. I didn't really know him very well, and I couldn't really figure him out, and I was saying like, are you excited about doing this thing? And he was like, I better, something about, I hope Gene appreciates what I'm doing, and stuff like that. And And I'm like, that's kind of a weird, you know, approach to take towards this, you know? And I kept talking, like, well, did you ever like Kiss? Do you, were you ever growing up with them? And he's like, oh, you don't understand. I was in my school, Kiss was my band. I was the ambassador for Kiss. Like, I put my name on the line for Kiss. I was the guy that was the Kiss guy in my class. And he said, when they put out The Elder, I lost all my clout with all my friends. I lost it all. And they ruined my life. He was 100% serious. And I got it then. I got it. And then he came in. We went to the studio. We had the stuff. It was still on 2-inch tape then. Turned on the mic, checked his voice, ran a pass from the beginning of the song. Said, and it felt pretty much like right. And he said, okay, I'm going to do one more. I'm going to double it. And he doubled it exactly the same as he did the first with, I don't think there was a single overdub at all. He just like nailed it the second time, exactly like the first time. I've never seen that happen. Or before.
His voice and almost chorusing on the tracks.
Yeah. But it was so close. I mean, it's very hard to do that. Usually to double your voice that closely takes many takes. You have to go through this line, do it again. I mean, I've done this with other bands where that's the technique they like to do in the studio. It's really hard to do and painstaking. And he just did it like right away. And it was the weirdest thing. And then we were just done. We were done in an hour. And so it was cool. We never played any shows. We never did any more than that. But it was a kind of a really cool experience. And the great thing was, like, Kiss guys are really into this project. They were calling everybody up. And I remember, like, Gene Simmons would call my house, like, and like we'd send him a mix of what we have.
Elect.
Like, Bill, it's your project. I don't want to, I'm not stepping on any toes, but could you bring down the hi-hat just a little bit, you know, like, yeah, I can't believe I'm talking to Gene Simmons on the phone. Me up, like, with all the, like, they really listened to it. They really focused on it. And like, it was really kind of cool. It was a really strange, but cool experience.
Well, why the name Shandy's Addiction? How did that come about? Do you remember?
It wasn't my idea. I don't know. I have no idea. That was Maynard's idea. I don't know. He wanted something to call it Satan's Pizza Box was the first thing he wanted to call it or something like that. I don't know. I didn't ask. I just said, sure, great. Sounds good.
Was it always going to be, is calling Dr. Love, right? Was that the only song discussed?
Yeah. I think so. No, I think they just wanted us to do a cover. And I think we all were like, that's a cool one. Because it had the cowbell in it, you know.
So that is a great song, though. That for
Kiss, it is an awesome song. That's a great album.
Well, that's my favorite record of theirs. That's the one I really? Grew Shandy, up on.
Of Shandy's Addiction? That's your favorite?
No, the Rock and Roll Over. That was the one I got when I was like 6 years old, 7 years old, and that was like amazing.
I remember I bought that record. I bought that record, and I was riding on my bike still. We went to the record store by my house, and Roddy was there. And I remember we went and took it to my house and put it on. Like, this is the best band in the world. I think I was in the eighth grade or something. I was like, this is the pinnacle of, you know, musical achievement.
and here he is 20 years later calling your house, asking you to take down the hi-hat.
It was pretty funny. Really funny. Really cool, though.
Okay.
So that is amazing.
You weren't assigned the song then. You were like, okay, do a cover, and you kind of talked about it, and you said
it was a lot of leeway. You know, we heard Garth Brooks was doing something. We heard all these things, and we were just like, well, we're going to do this. Yeah. And it was, you know, we just did it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about is the moment or the reaction of Faith No More members hearing the demo tape when you were changing singers to Mike Patton. I assume it was the Mr. Bungle tape that you guys had initially heard about Mike on?
Yes. So we played up in at Arcata at the university, and Trey had given us a demo tape of the band, and it was very much a metal tape. And Jim was really into it. He's playing it on the bus nonstop. And we didn't have a bus then, it was the van. But the thing about it was and we kind of liked it. We had some friends we turned on, that some guys that worked at Metal Blade, and they were really into it. And then they asked for more music, and then they got this tape that had a bunch of horns and stuff. And they were like, what the hell? You know, this isn't the demo that I heard. And I'd forgotten about it, but it came to a point where, you know, Chuck just wasn't working. And we just kept working. But the Chuck thing was just really, really cumbersome. And we were just like, what would we do? What would we do? And Chuck was a very unique guy. You know, so we kind of really couldn't be attached to what the result was going to be. We couldn't control it. We just had to kind of be open to it when it came. And Jim mentioned, well, Mr. Bungle, talk to the Mr. Bungle guy. And, we were like, sure, we'll try anybody. And he was one of the first guys that came down to San Francisco, to listen to our songs we were working on. And he was really a kid. I mean, still in school. We went to rehearsal and we went to go have a beer afterwards, but he'd never been in a bar before. So we're really green. And it was like, this is kind of weird, but what we're kind of open about it. And we turned on a tape recorder. He had some ideas when he was hearing the music and he wanted to know if he could just sing along with while we were playing. And I said, yeah, hell yeah. And we just turned on a tape recorder and a little blaster, and listen to it later. And then we went through about 10 other singers and I was like, wow, it's funny because he seemed like he really, really kind of felt good with it. But when we realized how weird our music was because other people were just wrestling with this stuff, we just think our stuff is really simple, bonehead simple, actually. And it's just like, well, come on, here's the music. What would you do with this, and people were just like, they weren't getting it, and Patton like completely got it like right away. So we're like, well, look at, he's a really green kid. He's really not coming from where we're coming from, like at culture wise or whatever. I mean, we're living in downtown San Francisco and like this old abandoned animal hospital, with like cages all over the place. And he's this kid, but he got it on the musical level. And it was just kind of like, we have to kind of, we got to follow this because there's something there. And I had one of these little X15, four track recorders where we had our band rehearsal on two tracks and we had to put vocals on the other. He'd come to my house and sing in a microphone. I have to say, from the first thing he did, I think the first song he tried with lyrics that he wrote was Out of Nowhere. And it was like already sounded like a finished song when it was just our stereo recording and his voice singing it. It was like, oh my God, he made a song out of it. This is the first thing we even tried. It was amazing.
Was he singing kind of like a traditional singer? Was he pulling on the vocal kind of
sounded exactly like it did on the record? He sang it exactly like he did on the record. Exactly.
Okay.
But he was like, I was watching him. I'm sitting in the room and he's got the microphone and he's singing exactly. It's like when I heard the album for the first time, it sounded like I heard a finished product when he did it. It was the weirdest thing. It was like, my God, he just completely nailed it.
Did he bring into the practice any of the kind of, I call them vocal gymnastics, right? The things that he does with his voice.
His pitch goes very high. No, he didn't. But that song Out of Nowhere his register gets very high and he sang it very strong. So, that's vocal gymnastics. I would think it's very operatic actually. But he was just, all I can say is he really just did what he thought the song needed and he was like right on the money.
Okay.
He actually even took the music and actually brought it even somewhere which made it even better. I would even go that far.
Do you still have all those old demo tapes and everything? Do you have them backed up?
I do. I don't have that old recorder anymore. A lot of these kinds of these cassettes are on a different format. I have all the cassettes in these boxes. I'm thinking I have to bake them, but you have to find the medium to play them back in so that they're the right speed, so they sound right. Because some of these, like the record four tracks on one side of a cassette. Some of them use two sides of a cassette. They're different cassette speeds. So, I don't remember even what I used. Like, this is like, we're talking 40 years ago now. Yeah. So 35 years ago. So they're there. I'm going to do it. I'm sure there's a guy somewhere around here that has all these old machines and we could pop it in. If it's not working, pop it into another one. I'm sure.
The Fostex F15 is a straight, four track, I think. Yeah. Because
is the X15, not the F, but yeah.
Okay.
But yes. Maybe it's straight.
We actually had old recordings that were done on a four track and it was really just left channel, right channel on each side of the tape. So we just did a pass and the recorder, we had to reverse one of them and then we were able to just sandwich them together. Perfect. So
you just do the whole side and then you do the whole side and you just.
And you have to reverse one because one of them's backwards. Right.
Very interesting.
Oh, right. Okay. There you go.
But that was
an interesting idea.
Yeah. That was a Tascam one. It worked for us, for our you know, shitty little band. But yeah, I don't know if that's a different recorder.
Yeah, no, hey. I do have them, so we'll see. Yeah.
There's your next record.
Exactly. So, you know,
the talking book version of it.
All right. So, Jared, Billy, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm really looking forward to this Eclipse soundtrack. 300 units available at Cool Arrow Records. And there's another URL I forgot, Billy.
Or Subsound. That's
Subsound.
Right.
Subsound. I'll get the link. Records. I'll put it in this Italy. Episode page. Hey, when are the records going to ship? If we order here in October, will we get them by end of the year?
I'm just getting the test pressing like today. Yes, they should be out before the end of the year, definitely.
Excellent.
We're hoping like, you know, November, December.
Okay, great. And I'm hoping we'll be able to see the full movie at some point. There's clips online. People can see the trailer online. It's a real moving trailer. I'm really interested to see the rest of it.
If I could find a way to do a DVD and I could sell it through like Cool Arrow, I would do it. So let's see, maybe.
Okay.
I don't
know.
You've
got the connections
there.
We're
talking about rights and we're talking about production companies. They, I mean, it's their budget, you know. I have full, you know, respect for that, but I think it should get out there. It's a great film.
Yeah. I think what Jared said earlier, seeing it on the big screen is probably, I'd love to be able to see it. And it sounds like
been making that is the way to see it.
With the film festivals and whatnot. So
that, or just at least see it in context also.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Or because when I watch a movie and I see a movie and I listen to the soundtrack and I'm like, oh my God, that's amazing. Then I'll go get the soundtrack or listen to it. And I'm like, okay, it's cool. But there's nothing like seeing it with the visuals. Yeah. Cause it's just, everything just is so right on, you know? And then when you hear it as a record, it's just sort of like, I want to say background, but it's cool. Like it's just amazing, but it's not the same as seeing.
Know? Well, so, to me, again, just listening to the digital files, I was absolutely captivated. And it's
cool.
One of the things to where
thank you.
I can't wait to see the other companion piece to it. Right.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, totally. Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming on the show. And again,
thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
It's awesome. No, really? Absolutely. You're welcome back anytime.
We will.
All right.
Awesome. Be back.
Oh man, I could just talk to those guys about music and gear all day long. And we kind of did. By the way, there's an extra 30 minutes of that conversation, an extended episode up at patreon.com/vinylguide, available only to the Dead Set legends who help support the show. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. And don't forget to pick up a copy of the Eclipse on vinyl. It's at subsound.bigcartel.com. Again, links are in this episode page. Only 300 units available. Make sure you grab one and get it done quick. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Put them on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter, put them in the Reddit forums or the Facebook groups or whatever social media exists, or even just tell your friends. Show them how to get a podcast on that smartphone of theirs. They'll appreciate it, and so will I. We'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.